they're captive. They can't even leave if they want to. And he could be so funny, and he could be so interesting. He could make this come alive. There's so many ways he could make American history, it was world history, just come become exciting and so on. And instead, he just sits there, and he's just beaten down. But I used to feel sorry for him. I did it in college in a thousand or more dull lectures of professors who were just coming in there and just sort of going through the motions. And I used to think, boy, when I'm doing this, when I'm in front of college audiences and when I'm teaching, I'm just going to make sure that when I get that classroom that they're going to want to come to my class. And sure enough, when I taught in high school, it was fun. My kids loved coming to class. And when I taught at the university, when I taught at St. John's University, the biggest problem I had with the dean at the university was that she called me down into her office and said, "You're going to have to stop having people come as guests into your classes on Tuesday and Thursday nights because they're taking up all of the parking places at the university." Because I had a class of 30 or 40 students, and there were times when 200 people would show up. And I was taping those lectures to create a book called Your Aronia Sounds. And I wrote it from those lectures that I had accumulated, and I taped everything. And I did most of it just from my heart. But I would use a form of entertainment and having people have fun and making it come alive and making it exciting and so on. And then after Aronia Sounds was published, and I was told by so many people about all the reasons why it was just another book on the list, and that there wouldn't be a second printing, that if we sell these out, there were 7,500, I think, books in the first printing, and if we sell those, that would be considered a successful publishing experience. And I had a different picture in my mind. And it had nothing to do with what I was being told by all of the publishers and people in New York. It had to do with that inner burning desire that I spoke about earlier. But it was a picture. And I saw myself as already doing what it is that I wasn't doing yet. And that's where I was. And so I consequently, when I couldn't get the kind of action that I wanted from them in terms of distribution, and I couldn't get them to even think about a second printing, I just became a bookstore. And I filed with the state authorities in New York and became a commercial establishment. And from that commercial establishment, I made a telephone call and ordered up the entire first printing that was left and had them shipped to my garage. And they ordered 2,500 more copies. And when I called up 2 or 3 weeks later and said, How's the book doing? And they said, "Oh, for gosh sakes, you're always asking questions." I was just a big pain in the ass to everybody there. And I had already ordered the second printing to be sent to my garage as well. And the publisher looked at it and said, "Boy, this book is really selling. It's really doing well." Meantime, I had almost 10,000 books there that I had to do something with. And I took those books literally. I took those books out and across the country, and I spoke all over the country and went to every small station and wherever anybody would take me. And it just kept doing it, going from one to the other. And I left one day. I was driving along the Long Island Expressway on my way from my home in Huntington to the university, and I realized that I couldn't do what I was doing any longer. Even though I had a guaranteed position for the rest of my life, I had a different picture in my head. And I didn't have the same internal enthusiasm for what I was doing any longer.